Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
We're going to take you first up to the Great Artesian Basin, a massive natural wonder of Australia that I suspect most people in the cities know very little about. We've probably heard of it, but what is it? It's a huge underground, very, very ancient water resource. It's big enough to fill Sydney Harbour 130,000 times. It covers one-fifth of Australia. How does water get into it and out? Are we stuffing it up? And how does it actually work? Your questions too. Love you to join that conversation. 1-300-800-222. Text 0467-922702. We'll also be investigating the government's announcement on the promise to reduce energy prices. Prime Minister Scott Morrison's asked the energy regulator to introduce a default market offer for energy prices for households and small businesses. How's that going to look? How will it work? And will it make a difference? The ABC's business reporter Carrington Clark has run the ruler over that and will have some answers. And eating tonight. Well, if the idea of lightly basting a caterpillar in soy sauce and forking it up for dinner doesn't appeal to you, probably join the club. But eating insects, they say some, is the answer to global protein scarcities. Kilogram for kilogram, ants pack more protein than most other food sources. Yes, but then there is the ick factor. We'll talk about eating insects a bit later. The mighty challenge, of course, and in our issue tonight, there's been a big push today for the government to fund more, by tens of millions more, to fund more money to elite sport. Sporting legends from Ian Thorpe to Herb Elliott have been asking the government to cough up and fund elite sport properly in Australia. How important is it, do you think, that governments fund elite sport as opposed to grassroots sport and community sporting activities? We'll talk about that a bit later in the program as well.
Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Tonight on the show, how many of you know about Australia's Great Artesian Basin? It's one of the most important water resources in the country. Maybe the most, in a way. Stretching from Cape York in the north, down to Dubbo and across to Coober Pedy. Fascinating to think. It covers almost a fifth of the entire continent. The Great Artesian Basin, the Australian Great Artesian Basin, is the largest and deepest artesian basin in the world. It's 3,000 metres deep in some places, and it's estimated to contain, get your head around this, nearly 65,000 cubic kilometres of groundwater. There's a hell of a lot of management that goes into running the basin. The basin's been sustaining Indigenous Australians, of course, for thousands of years. Europeans discovered the water in 1878 when a bore was sunk near Bourke in New South Wales. One of our most famous poets, of course, wrote about the basin. Here's a snippet from Banjo Patterson's Song of the Artesian Water.
Now the stock have started dying, for the Lord has sent a drought. But we're sick of prayers and providence. We're going to do without. With the derricks up above us and the solid earth below, we're waiting at the lever for the word to let her go. Sinking down, deeper down, ah, we'll sink it deeper down, as the drill is plugging downward at 1,000 feet of level. If the Lord won't send us water, ah, well, we'll get it from the devil. Yes, we'll get it from the devil, deeper down.
Groundwater from the basin is a vital resource for pastoral, agricultural and extractive industries, particularly town water supplies and springs. So we'll talk about how the water's used tonight, the industries it supports, and indeed how the basin was originally formed. Just last week, one of Australia's richest individuals declared the basin was the answer to Australia's water problems. Is that right? If you've got a question, you can also call us 1-300-800-222. Joining us tonight is Dr. Gavin Mudd. He's an associate professor in the Department of Environmental Engineering at RMIT in Melbourne. Gavin, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
G'day. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Terrific to have you with us. And also joining us is Dr. Martin Anderson, who's an associate professor with the Water Research Laboratory and School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of New South Wales. Two men well-versed in the basin. Martin, good to have you with us as well, and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you, Philip.
Gavin, can we start with you? Give us a sense of how big it is.
I guess to try and explain that, I think you sort of touched on it earlier too. Like often a good sort of comparison is comparing the volumes of water to things like the Sydney Harbour and how much water that contains. And we know the Sydney Harbour contains about 500 billion litres or 500 million cubic metres. And so if we look at the basin, the volume of water that's stored is several thousand times the volume of water stored in Sydney Harbour. And so it's the estimates vary a bit, but it's certainly somewhere in that sort of magnitude. So it's certainly an extraordinarily large groundwater resource that exists over a large part of eastern Australia.
What actually is it? I'm sure this puzzles some people. I mean, is it a vast underground cavern that's got water in it, or is it something? What actually is it?
The analogy I use when teaching students groundwater is simply a bag of marbles, and is one way we find groundwater. If you're walking along a beach and you see a wave come in and the water sort of flows down, and the water is not flowing through the actual sand grains, it's actually flowing around the sand grains. And so it's actually the gaps between each of those individual sand grains. So hopefully a good sort of image is to think of a bag of marbles, and the water is contained in all the gaps between each marble. And so that those gaps can extend wherever those marbles are found, so to speak. And so the other type of system that we often find in groundwater, if we can imagine sort of a large sort of slab of concrete and we get a big crack going up the middle of it, that crack can often, if it's filled with water, for example, that's another way that we can find groundwater. And so typically they're the two primary sort of ways that we find groundwater. So certainly for something like the Great Artesian Basin, we're looking at a sandstone, and sometimes it's a cemented sandstone, so the gaps have been reduced between the sand particles. But it's effectively all we're really thinking about is the ability for water to flow around those sand grains, between them and so on. And that's what creates that big store of water, because these sandstones, like we see in Sydney and Kakadu and elsewhere, these sandstones are very large geological systems, and so they can store effectively a huge amount of groundwater.
So the water's in the rock, as it were?
Absolutely.
It's not, as I say, it's not you drill a hole and there's a big almighty cave underneath there.
You can find some groundwater systems that are certainly like that. And so if you look at the Nullarbor Plain, for example, it's what we call a karst or a limestone system. And so gradually over time, the movement of water through that limestone dissolves that limestone, and then you can get caves and large sort of caverns. And so limestone systems tend to be a different system when we're looking at groundwater. But for the Great Artesian Basin, what we're really talking about is what we often call a porous media, like a sort of a sandstone, which you can visualize from sort of thinking about the Sydney sandstones or Kakadu sandstones and all the ones similar around Australia and the world, I guess. So, yeah.
Europeans don't discover this until later on in the 19th century, but, of course, Indigenous Australians always knew about it. How did they source the water if it's underneath the ground in rocks?
I guess it's a puzzle. You're walking through the desert and yet you see this water actively flowing at the surface. And I still vividly remember the first time I went to the Mount Springs around sort of Lake Eyre South, and you see these features, these mounds that are actively flowing water. And you think, this landscape is incredibly flat and yet you've got flowing water that's clearly coming from underground. And so people started to think about that. And when, of course, necessity, I guess, is always the mother of invention. And so there was a need to find water. And so they said, well, where is that water coming from? It's clearly coming from underground. And so let's drill and see if we can find the source. And so I think the other thing to remember in all of that is that a lot of the early explorers were using knowledge from Indigenous groups of the springs in order to navigate the country. And so they were critically important, not only for Indigenous people, but the early exploration of inland Australia by Australians.
Mm. Okay. So, I mean,
can I add something there?
Yes, Martin. Yeah, go on.
Thanks, Gavin. The Aboriginal people also could distinguish between what they called on top water and the deep water. Mm-hmm. So they had a quite good sense of this groundwater resource and also how it linked through the underground system. And so they knew that in times of drought, that was the resource they could rely on because it would always be there, whereas the on-top water was more ephemeral water that comes and goes with floods and droughts. So they actually had a very intimate knowledge of the Great Artesian Basin.
So they knew that if there wasn't water here, they knew there'd be somewhere else because they knew where the water was flowing to.
And part of their song lines as well would guide them to where those water resources could be found.
Absolutely.
How does it, when you say, okay, so the water's in the rocks, one of the great stories of Australia, of course, is the search for the inland sea because everyone was trying to solve the riddle of the rivers because the rivers all seemed to flow to the west. So if the rivers flowed to the west, there must be something there. They thought it must be a giant inland sea. Of course, there wasn't. They never found it. Is the Great Artesian Basin the inland sea that they were looking for?
There was a sea, actually, if you go back in geological timescale. Hmm. So if you go back to around the Cretaceous period, there was a big ocean there. Before that ocean was there, there was a low-lying landscape with lots of sedimentations of sand, a little bit like you see around Sydney with the Hawkesbury sandstone, so some similar type of formations. And gradually, as the sea came in, it started depositing mud. Mm-hmm. And mud, when that consolidates, turn into very tight type of rocks, mudstones and shales. And water doesn't flow through that very well. So that becomes a cap on top of these sandstones. And so you think about it as almost like a layer cake with the top layer being very tight. And so you think, how does the water get in and out of that? But it's a layer cake that's bent, like in a bathtub.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the edges, this porous rock is poking out. And that's where the water gets in and out. So on the eastern side, on the Great Divide, we have water entering the rock. And then it flows underneath this capped system, and it gets pressurized.
And it gets trapped under there.
It gets trapped under there.
Where does it? What's the flow of it? Does it always flow in one direction?
It flows mainly in a westerly and southwesterly direction.
Right. So if it flows, it must flow to somewhere. Where does it flow to?
Well, before European settlement and use of the Great Artesian Basin, it flowed towards springs at the perimeter. So along the southern edge, as well as the western edge, there's all these natural springs that Gavin also talked about. And that's the exit point of this water.
I think the other thing to sort of remember there as well is that if you've got water, it will always flow downhill. And if we've got the Great Divide where the sandstones are sort of poking out or sort of exposed at the surface, they're typically about 400 to 500 meters above sea level. And the southwestern side, where the main sort of flow path is for the Great Artesian Basin down around Lake Eyre, that's effectively at sea level or slightly below. And so effectively you're starting at about 400 or 500 meters in the eastern side, and as you flow west and southwest, you're effectively going down to zero. So it's like you've got a bathtub and you've tilted it, and so one side is higher than the other, and that's where that pressure really starts from.
Mm. Okay. It's the water's interesting though, isn't it? It's got an interesting chemistry, Martin. Maybe you could talk some more about this. It's not that great for irrigation, but it is okay for town water supplies.
Yeah.
And people who think it's a miracle drought cure, it's more complicated than that, isn't it?
It is indeed. So part of the reason why it has a special chemistry is because it's in contact with the rocks for a very long time.
Hmm.
The flow rate in the GAB is about 1 to 5 meters per year. So the water moves incredibly slowly in this southeasterly direction. And so it has a lot of time to dissolve rocks. And that builds up a type of salt that's called sodium bicarbonate, which is basically baking soda.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of sodium bicarbonate destroys the soil if you want to use it for irrigation. So it's not very good for growing crops, but it's the salt levels are not so high that livestock can't use it.
So livestock can drink it. Humans can drink it.
Yes.
Without treatment?
Yeah, particularly because it's been so long underground that it's safe in terms of bacteria and pathogens.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to do a bit of aeration, so you air it, and you get rid of some sulfides that can have kind of a rotten egg smell, and some iron oxides at times as well, and then it's perfectly drinkable. You probably wouldn't want to always drink it because it has quite high sodium levels, which can give you problems with high blood pressure. But certainly during droughts, you can drink it. I was in Walgett a couple of weeks ago, and they're in drought at the moment. There's no surface water. And we were drinking GAB water out of the tap. And you can think of it as vintage water because it's very old.
Hmm.
In some parts of the basin, it's been estimated using tracers that it is 1 to 2 million years old.
Really?
Yeah.
The water you're drinking is a million years old.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's pretty easy to sort of to justify that, because if you go from the Great Divide in Queensland down the longest flow path towards Lake Eyre, it's roughly about 2,000 kilometres or 2 mm-hmm. million metres. And so if you're flowing at approximately, say, 1 metre per year, that's 2 million years right there. And so it's pretty easy to sort of go through sort of the calculations, I guess, and then line that up with some of the isotopes and tracers and the chemistry and the and all of the physical properties of the sandstone and sort of validate this sort of these numbers. And it's a remarkable system.
Hmm. So just to finish that conversation about where the water comes from. So basically the water that, I mean, from rainfall and from river flow, in other words, the riddle of the rivers.
Yeah.
That's where the water comes from.
Yeah, and it helps that you got the Great Divide because it collects rainwater.
Yep.
It always rains more in mountains, and so you got a good amount of rainfall there that can penetrate the soils and into the sandstones.
Hmm.
And rivers that flow across that sandstone as well will lose water into the ground. So that's the main, we call it the recharge area for the GAB.
Mm. Yeah, an important fact about that, actually, just before we do move on, but yeah, is that part of the reason we know we have continuing recharge going into the basin is the bores and looking at the groundwater levels in those recharge areas, and they're constant. And so we know from modern times that we are actually getting a generally good recharge into the aquifers of the Great Artesian Basin.
Is that right? So we're not depleting the resource.
Well, it's still being replenished, but due to the drilling that's happened in the last 140 years, we have lowered the pressure in parts of the basin. So the water levels and the water pressure has dropped, and that's impacted on some bores that have stopped flowing, and it's also impacted on some of the springs. So some of the springs have gone dry. So it's not like we have an endless supply or that we can use it without impact on the natural environment.
Mm.
Yeah, effectively, when a system is moving so slow, it's very tempting. And normally in groundwater, we always like to think, you know, if we've got a bathtub or a basin, an aquifer, we have to think of how much is coming in, how much is coming out, as well as how much is stored in the system. But for something like the GAB, where it's such a slow-moving system, really the primary values of it is the fact that it's artesian. It's actually naturally pressured so that water will flow at surface. And so that is one of the key things we need to protect. And so as well as the springs and so on. And so that's really – so it's not so much just a volume question. It's really about managing – things like the pressure and also the values such as springs agricultural use and so on.
Mm. Tony from Thornbury's texted me saying, isn't all water millions of years old? The earth doesn't make much new water. It just recycles what's always been there. Yes, okay, point to you, Tony. I suppose we'd agree with that in a general theoretical sense, wouldn't we, Martin?
It gets a bit philosophical there.
It does.
So, of course, we're not generating new water as such, but we're talking about it from a point of view of that particular system.
Hmm.
So if you've got a little aquifer somewhere on the coast, water will go through it in 10 years.
What we're saying, I suppose, is that it hasn't been through the evaporation rain cycle. It's just
no.
It's rained, it's gone in there.
It's the time since it entered the ground.
Yeah, it's been there for a million, maybe 2 million years.
Yeah.
Roger from Fingal Bay, north of Newcastle, has been waiting on there too. Hi, Rog.
Good evening.
How evening.
I used to work at Burleigh in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
and we were told that the water that runs from Cape York to the jump-ups in South Australia was 7 million years old. But the thing we used to notice about it, it used to rot the cotton in our dungarees,
mm-hmm.
and your hair looked like ginger meggs. Stand straight up in the air. So What I wanted to ask the blokes from the university,
yep.
would it be feasible in the flood country in the Cape York to put in injection points to put water back into the system. Is that an idea or is that being silly?
Because this is one of the great things, isn't it? Where so much water falls on Northern Australia and we could use it elsewhere, could you put it into the basin? Is that basically what you're asking, Rog?
Yes, yeah. And all these mega mines they build in the day, which are 5 kilometres deep and 20 kilometres around, if they were filled with water, we could pump that back into the ground.
Yeah, I don't know, Martin, do I have a go at this?
It's certainly something that various researchers around Australia is looking at. It's got different names. It's called Managed Aquifer Recharge, and that is to take a source of water and put it back into the ground. Some of the problems there is that there's a limit to how much the ground can accept, and I'm guessing that up in Cape York, this happens naturally in the wet season.
Anyway.
And most of the water will run off the surface. So what you could do is make some infiltration dams and collect water that you keep towards the dry season and you keep infiltrating through the dry season. I think this type of system is probably better suited for areas further south where you capture big rainfall events and infiltrate them rather than in Cape York.
That's what I wanted to hear, like someone thinking about these things. But if you take a lesson from an old man, Sir Sidney Kidman, he'd only buy stations where there was flowing water. And that is why you'll find at Napa Mary and stations in the Channel Country. There was always a chance of floods coming down. And cattle do better on flowing water than boil water.
Okay. Yeah, the other thing that's sort of noting here as well is that if you look at the general cost of building things like pipelines and the energy cost of actually pumping water, typically a rule of thumb that I've always sort of seen out there is that it's actually very energy intensive to pump water. And typically, once you get up to 200 kilometres or more, it's actually less energy intensive to build a desalination plant. And so in some ways, it always sounds attractive.
A lot of people don't understand that, do they? That's right. Because pumping water sounds easy, but actually pumping it over long distances.
Well, it takes diesel, it takes electricity or renewable energy, wherever that's coming from. But it's actually very energy intensive to pump water. And so typically, a normal sort of rule of thumb would be anything more than 200 kilometres. It's actually less energy intensive to build a desalination plant. So I think we need to make sure that when we're looking at some of these options, as Martin was saying as well, we have to understand the system. Cape York is typically a very underutilized part of the GAB. It's also a very poorly studied part of the GAB. But we do know that there is a very strong recharge in those areas. The flow that you see in those rivers during the dry season when there's no rainfall is actually groundwater discharge coming out of the GAB. And so that's an area where we understand some of the basics, but the detailed studies are really are yet to be done, I think.
Well, I'm getting a lot of texts and a lot of calls too about an issue which I knew would arise, which is fracking and coal seam gas exploration. I know, Martin, you've done some work on this. Let's take a call and then you can give us your expertise about it as well. Hi, Peter.
Hi.
You're in Perth. Yep. Go on.
Yeah, mate. Yeah, I'm just really concerned about they're trying to start the fracking up here. And just recently, like within 15 years ago, they found that they found a big artesian well area about five times the size of Sydney Harbour west of Leinster. I'm sorry, east of Leinster. We're on the west side. They're on the east side. So, yeah. And it concerns me that this fracking, that all the poisons that they pump in and the chemicals that they send down there to crack the rocks open and all that, like, it's got to go somewhere. And they'd suck it back out again.
Yeah, okay. I mean, look, it's a fair question. It's asked by a lot of people too.
Yeah.
Martin, you've been working on this, haven't you?
Yes. It's a very contentious issue, and it's very polarized in the Australian society. And I think that doesn't really help in trying to solve the problems and trying to understand the system. So on one side, you've got environmentalists that probably are taking their lessons from America, where The geology is different.
Mm-hmm.
So they're taking some quite scary stories across to Australia and using that as an example. And then on the other side of the coin, you have an industry that tries to say there's nothing here to see. It's all fine. We got it all under control. And also saying, you know, this is information that's commercial in confidence. So you don't really feel that they're playing with an open hand of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And so that creates that tension and normal people caught in the middle worrying about what is this all about. And I think there is a couple of things I'd like to emphasize. The first thing is that it's very, very context specific. So it really depends where you are.
Right.
If you're up in Queensland in the Bowen or Surat Basin towards the edge of the basin, the coal seams there are quite close to the surface and they're quite close to aquifers, such as the Great Artesian Basin.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you want to do fracking or take out coal seam gas in those areas, you've got to be very careful that you're not contaminating your aquifers in that area. If you move further south, down into New South Wales, some of the coal seams that they're looking at there are much deeper. They're below very tight rock,
mm-hmm.
and so the risks are much smaller there. So you've got to look at the local context, certainly. The other thing I'd like to emphasize as well, just before you take over again, is that we know very little about the subsurface. It's very, very hard to characterize and measure.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at a river, you can take a boat down the river, you can fly a helicopter down the river. Groundwater, we only really have access in the boreholes, which only is a fraction of the whole system. So it's almost like exploring the deep ocean. And therefore, there's always a risk of something being down there that we weren't aware of. So every time we try to do things like coal seam gas, there might be unexpected ways that the system responds to that. So really what we need, and I would say that as a researcher, of course, is we need more research.
Mm. But you're saying, though, that it is... Sorry, Gavin, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, there's a bunch of points, I think, to make. And I think the first one is there's a big distinction between shale gas versus coal seam gas.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in America, it's almost predominantly shale gas. And a lot of the impacts in America are not actually related to the geology. They're actually related to the fact that the wells are leaking. And so the wells have been drilled so fast that the boom times in the industry, while the oil price was high, because shale gas, not only does it produce gas, it also produces hydrocarbon liquids. And those liquids attract the oil price. And that was a great effective subsidy to gas while the oil price was high. And so... So there was a huge pressure in the industry to actually just drill and drill and drill. And so the standards of construction weren't always up to standard. And so that's where the main mechanism that we see, where that you've actually got these leaking gas bores that are contaminating some of the shallow aquifers, because some of the deep shale gas systems in America are actually down 2 or 3 kilometres. And so that's a really important distinction. And I think one thing have a different opinion on to Martin is that the coal seam gas operations in Queensland are actually inside the GAB, and they're actually pumping out water from aquifers and aquitards and the systems and the layers of the Great Artesian Basin. And that's one of the huge bones of contention, is because coal seam gas doesn't have to account for its water. If you're a farmer, you do. You have to have a license. And so coal seam gas doesn't. Now, when we first started Australia...
What do you mean? That you can extract coal seam gas and use as much of the basin as you like?
It's considered a byproduct. It's actually licensed under the Petroleum and Gas Act. And so
that's one of the significant problems.
There's no limit.
You can pump out as much as you want because you don't have to get a license for that.
So they're not after the water. It just happens as they depressurize the system.
Yeah.
They get a mixture of gas and water coming out.
Yeah.
And so for them, the water is just something that they need to kind of manage and get rid of.
Hmm.
Yeah, but the farmers, and especially in the Darling Downs area where the coal seam gas operations are actually quite shallow, sometimes only a couple of 100 metres deep. And so the farmers are accessing those same areas for groundwater. And so one of the big failures that I see, and this is something that I keep pointing out all the time, the baseline studies included no methane before all of these operations started. And so now we've depressurized the groundwater system, so we've extracted a lot of groundwater in order to get the gas to flow. That's allowed methane to start flowing through the geology, and it will flow up an old coal exploration bore, a current groundwater bore. It's certainly how I explain the bubbling in the Condamine River, for example. And so I think because we didn't have baseline studies, no coal seam gas operation is required to monitor for methane. So we can't unpack these processes and actually assign impact or attribute the cause of what we're seeing in the field. But that's what farmers are seeing in their fields, and that's what's driven a lot of the community concern. It's a very real issue.
But you're saying from a scientific point of view, we ought to be concerned about it because we don't know enough about it at the moment. Until we know more about it, we probably shouldn't be doing what we're doing.
Absolutely. And I think that also has to be put in the context of the broader energy debate. And that's actually whether it's climate change and accounting properly for all of these lost methane emissions or fugitive emissions, as they're often called. If we have a good, accurate account of that, I think the supposed benefit that certainly industry claims for coal seam gas, I think it certainly starts to evaporate.
Mm. We talk about the Great Artesian Basin and the effect on it of coal seam gas exploration, or fracking as it's often said. Dr. Gavin Mudd's with us from the University from RMIT in Melbourne, and Dr. Martin Anderson from the University of New South Wales as well. Let's get back to some calls. Neil, hello.
Good evening. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I think the Great Artesian Basin is underestimated. It's one of the most wonderful resources Australia has got that we need to take care of. And we're going into this change in weather patterns. The advantage with the, I see it, is the basin is that the water doesn't evaporate. People say build more dams, but you've got to have the right site where the dam doesn't leak. And I think that we can look at, we should be looking at, reinjecting as much as we can, particularly in wet years where floodplains are, that if some system we can bore down to those levels and fill those holes with filter sand, and try and get more in there. Because an artesian system, you don't have to travel the water. All you've got to do is lift it for agriculture. And I think people are underestimating the advantages of it.
Hmm.
I had an experience a couple of years ago when the drought was on, talking to a chap from Junee in New South Wales, and he said he had bore water at his residence that was only down 4 feet in normal years, and it was down 10 feet that particular year. And I said, how come it's down lower? And he said, because Blowering Dam's empty. He said, there's a hole in Blowering Dam, and he said, and it flows past us.
Hmm.
You know, I think it's a great resource.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Thanks for the call. I mean, Martin, you'd agree.
Yeah, certainly.
Recharging the aquifer is a possibility.
Certainly. So you need one of two things to be able to do this. You need some storage space that is not already full of water.
Mm-hmm.
You actually need some porous rock where you can put this water in. Or you need some salty rock where you can displace the salt water with fresh water that you can later extract. And so it's more limited than you think, finding those areas. And as Gavin pointed out earlier about Cape York, is that if you put too much water in, it's just going to come back out again where you've got streams and rivers. So there's some limitations to where you can do this and how much you can do it. There's certainly a potential for it, but it will work only in some areas and not in other areas. I think with the GAB, one of the solutions is to manage it better by capping more of the free-flowing bores that are still out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not aware of the current number, but I think it's probably in the thousands still of bores that are flowing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, we get the pressure back up again, and we can tap into the system during droughts and manage it more sustainably.
Gavin, what do you think about the management of the basin anyway? Is it as bad as the unholy mess we've made of the Murray-Darling?
No, it's actually the complete opposite. And I think if we look at both South Australia and who started actually capping bores, just like Martin suggested, in the 1970s. And so and they've been continuing that pretty much ever since. And so for about the last 20, 25 years, the federal government, along with state governments and landholders, have had what we call the Great Artesian Basin Sustainability Initiative. And that's basically investing. A lot of the bores were drilled sometimes 50 or 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and they were corroded, they were failing, and therefore free-flowing. There was no ability to control the amount of water you actually extracted. Water would just flow freely across the land, and sometimes millions of litres a day. And what we know, that if we reduce that volume, so if we actually put in a modern headworks and piping and valving, all of that to actually make sure that we can limit the amount of water that we take to just the amount that cattle need or sheep need maybe or whatever, that's only a small fraction. It might only be 5 or 10% of what used to free flow at the surface. And so that sort of investment in the GAB has probably saved hundreds of thousands of millions of litres per year. And so from the more recent sort of resource studies that have been done, and that almost equals the amount of recharge that we estimate in the Great Artesian Basin. And so I think we've had a huge success story, and I think it's something that we're not celebrating enough. And it's actually worked, because now farmers, by actually using less water, the water that was basically draining out before was reducing pressure. And so what we're seeing now is a big recovery in pressure. Hmm. And that increased pressure also means that sometimes bores that haven't flowed for 75 years are now flowing. And then they have to be capped as well. But also for farmers, what that means is that if they've got more pressure in their bores, they can actually use that pressure and then push water to further parts of their property. And they can actually much more efficiently manage the water use on their property, help get rid of things like whether it's a prickly acacia, manage the sort of the introduction of water into dry ecosystems that weren't used to water, and so that changes some of the biodiversity and so on. And so it's allowed a lot of pastoralists and stations out there to become much, much better land managers, because they're much more efficient in the way they use their water, and it's given them so much more. And it's something that I think we really don't understand or appreciate well enough.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. John from Bateman's Base is some of the water radioactive? There's a lot of radioactivity deep below the surface,
It does collect natural radioactive elements from the rock. Mm-hmm. Again, this very long travel time and time to react with the rocks. So it is slightly radioactive. Not to a degree that I would worry about it.
It's but not injurious to health.
It will have
natural, well below drinking water standards, yeah.
Yeah, it'll have natural radon, radium, and in some cases also uranium.
Mm. Okay. Stephen, who's an environmental engineer. Hello, Stephen.
Yeah, hi, guys. And I'm actually really enjoying this seminar. I'm learning a lot, and you can never learn too much about water. The thing that prompted me to call was the fellow that rang in about injecting water into aquifers. Mm-hmm. That's actually been done in in the Orange County in California, Water Factory 21, where they were drawing water out of the aquifer, and they found that seawater had encroached into the aquifer to a distance of 5 kilometres inland from the coastline there, which was quite alarming. So they started injecting their wastewater back into the aquifer as a method of pushing the seawater back, of course, restoring it.
I think it was actually recycled water there, to be specific.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and also, though, the rock strata. Now, I don't pretend to know the geology of California or any other part of the United States, for that matter, but it appeared to give it a sort of a final clean, made it more acceptable. People are reluctant to drink recycled water, but if it's come back out of the ground, even if it's been previously recycled, they seem to have a lot more amenable. It's like the Singaporeans, instead of using desalination, they used a desalination plant to tertiary treat wastewater, then they pumped it straight back into their reservoir, and people happily drink it. And I don't know if you guys, I'm quite sure you have said it tonight, but I did probably miss the early part. People have to keep in mind one important factor, and that is that only 1% of the world's water is fit for human consumption, and that if a country like Namibia can drought-proof itself 51 years ago, we I think, falling well behind the game.
Hmm. Fair enough. Thanks, Stephen. Gavin, do you want to comment on that? Means of tertiary treating wastewater?
It's what we call aquifer storage treatment and recovery. It's actually already being done in Australia. It's actually being done in Adelaide, and Adelaide's been some of the real pioneers through CSIRO and Flinders University there. But it's something that Adelaide's been doing as part of their water system and so on for decades. And so it's a very important part. But I think one of the issues with that we have to make sure we're careful about with a lot of these types of systems is there's an example in Florida where for exactly the same reasons in Orange County, they started injecting stormwater in their case, and they were actually mobilizing arsenic from the aquifer into the groundwater. And so the arsenic concentrations went well above drinking water standards there. And so you have to make sure that if you're going to go ahead with some kind of managed aquifer recharge project, that you do understand the chemistry of the aquifer, the pressure conditions and the volumes and flow rates and all of that. It's something that does need very careful study and engineering.
Hmm. Okay, fair enough. George, hello.
Well, how are you going?
Not bad, George.
It's nice to hear you talking about that fact about water.
Yeah, no, we love talking about water here on the program, George. Here. Where are you, George? Oh, you're in Kingston, in Queensland.
I'm in Kingston, Queensland.
Yep, okay.
And what I was reading about was the two factors. One, the bloke that built the Sydney Harbour Bridge,
yep,
and the Story Bridge.
Bradfield, you mean?
Bradfield. He recommended Three Rivers in Queensland to drill through the range and feed it into the inland to stop mud getting out into the reef. And then we have...
Do you know which rivers they were, George?
Yes, one was the Burdekin.
Yep.
They were three in a row. The Burdekin was the top one and the other two were below it.
Mm.
And then we have another one. He mentioned that the water travels from Toowoomba to Stradbroke Island, which is off Brisbane.
Mm.
Now, that water is shipped back across the bay and pumped into the water system for the Redlands area. And it's beautiful water to drink.
Mm.
Really is. And they never seem to have a shortage of it or anything.
Mm. Well, I'd like to ask Gavin about this. I mean, Australia's been a land of big water dreams over the years.
Oh, yeah.
In its history, Gavin, hasn't it? Turning the rivers back's always been one of the great. I mean, every generation almost has come up with a dreamer about turning the rivers back, haven't they?
Yeah, and I still hear dreams about converting or diverting the Kimberley rivers down to Perth, or
that's right,
or yeah, things like that. And it's gravity gets in the way. You've got the energy costs, but as we've seen in Victoria with the Snowy River, if you're taking the water out of the Snowy to turn that inland, it ain't flowing down the Snowy anymore, and so. And so then you have to make sure that you understand what the impacts are on whether it's the Snowy or in this case the Burdekin, and we carefully weigh those up. There's a lot of cane farms and other sort of users of that water from those sort of systems. And so these are not easy issues. They're actually quite complex.
Mm.
It's also been tried internationally suggested in Russia and places like China, and usually they come with big environmental costs. To ecosystems that rely on that water.
Because if you start mucking around with river flow,
yeah,
then you'll have huge consequential effects.
Exactly.
I think, common sense would tell you that, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Wayne from Christmas Hills. Hello, Wayne.
I was wondering about with South Australia, they've got the Beverley uranium mine and they're talking about storing nuclear waste. Is that a threat to the Artesian Basin? And Maralinga too.
I guess I'm happy to take that one if you like. It's
someone who's
looked at that many years ago. But Maralinga is way out west in South Australia. It's far west of the Great Artesian Basin. There is a sort of another extension geologically of the GAB, which we call the Arkaringa Basin. And in reality, the GAB is actually a series of basins that are largely all connected. But the Arkaringa Basin, which is mainly where you find Cooper Pedy, is actually, from a groundwater point of view, it is not connected to the main part of the GAB. And so from a geology point of view, it's the same rocks. But from a hydrogeology point of view or groundwater point of view, it's an isolated sort of separate system. And Maralinga is certainly much further west than that. And so there's certainly plenty of issues with the failed rehab at Maralinga. But the GAB is not one of them.
It's not connected to it. No.
Yeah. For the Beverley uranium mine, it's... I guess a shallow mine. It actually injects sulfuric acid into a shallow sort of sand aquifer where the uranium is found. It's chemically bound on the surfaces of the sand grains, and so that acid dissolves the uranium, They pump that solution back to the surface and then recover the uranium from the solution in a big chemical plant. And so it's they use a small amount of GAB water as part of their process, and they extract that from probably about 150 metres deeper than where they're actively mining. And there's a very thick mudstone in between the two, and I think, you know, I've looked at this before, and certainly I'm convinced that that's not the big risk. The big risk is that they're not required to remediate the groundwater to baseline conditions in the aquifer they're mining, and that to me has always been the big issue with Beverley for more than 20 years.
Hmm. Okay, thanks for that. Shane in Brisbane. Hello, Shane.
Hi, g'day, Phil. How are you?
Not bad.
Hey, it's funny the subject come up. We were talking about this the other night about water,
mm-hmm.
and apparently some years ago, and it goes back to the days when they put the pipeline through from Perth to Kalgoorlie,
mm-hmm.
and apparently the same chap, the name is actually missing, but the same chap was talking about the far north and northern ends of Australia, and he was talking about they could actually put a locks and pipelines through to the Diamantina or the Barku River,
yep.
so that the water would flow via locks and dams into the main rivers of Australia, and we would not have a lack of water anywhere south of...
This is the idea of tapping the flow of northern Australia's rivers and somehow tipping the water into the rest of Australia's, particularly the southeast river systems.
Yeah, they were looking at the floodplains as well. Apparently,
yeah,
there is designs for this somewhere. Mm. They were talking about. Someone actually designed it. Designed the drainage system.
Okay, let's ask Gavin about it. Gavin, idea's been around for a while, hasn't it?
Yeah, there's various versions of it. excuse me. One of the big issues is, of course, cost. One of the other big issues is, of course, the impacts on the ecosystems and the users of a lot of the northern rivers, of which there are many, and including a lot of indigenous values and communities as well. Mm-hmm. One of the other points to make, and we've seen this in the GAB, where you have a free-flowing bore, you're introducing water commonly into an arid and often hyper-arid ecosystem that is not used to water. And so you're introducing water, and that changes the species and the biodiversity mix in those areas. And often it's been good vectors for things like weeds and feral animals and so on. And so we need to be very careful. If we're introducing water into ecosystems that are naturally very dry, i.e. arid and hyper-arid ecosystems, we need to be very careful about how we do that, if we can do that. And so, I think what we're seeing is that things like desalination and so on are just becoming so much cheaper and scalable now that some of these big options like trying to divert rivers are really just not economic.
And to add to that, Gavin, is when you have these very arid areas, you might have a lot of salt stored. And you
Absolutely.
Can mobilise that salt, and then you get salty water that's not useful.
Which we saw, which we've seen in the Murray-Darling, haven't
yes,
we? I mean, this
exactly.
has been a major
and
issue
West
in the Murray,
Australia too. Yep.
In the Murray-Darling, one of the major issues, has been the salination of the rising salinity caused by over irrigation,
or just changing the way you manage water so it goes in different areas.
Gavin, just to underline that point you're making, though, you're saying that technologically these days, the economics of building desalination plants. It's more economic to build a desalination plant if you're thinking of pumping water more than 200 k's.
Typically, if you look at the cost of energy, I think Bob Carr crystallised it very well in a way, if you forgive the pun, but when he was saying that desalination is like bottled electricity, it's very energy intensive. And so if you look at the efficiency now that they can build desalination plants with, and the large scales, as we've seen here in Victoria, and elsewhere around Australia, desal plants work, and they're big. They do cost a lot of money to build, but they're efficient in the way they can deliver water. And so, I think if you're looking at the energy cost of actually pumping water, it does cost a lot of energy to pump water, and that means a lot of cost as well.
Hmm. Yes. Okay. All right. If you're building the Perth to Kalgoorlie pipeline today, you probably wouldn't do it, is what you're saying.
Who knows? I haven't seen the sums on that one. That's a good question.
Yeah, all right. Phil from Mildura. Hi, Phil. Yeah, good.
One simple question. Why is the Darling dry?
I don't know. But anybody want to have a go at this? Martin?
Could you repeat the question, please?
Why is the Darling?
why is the Darling dry, and also why are they pipelined from the Darling up to Broken Hill?
So the Darling is naturally a intermittent river. So it goes through these flow and dry cycles, but it's certainly been exacerbated by a lot of agricultural activity that divert water for flood irrigation and then evaporation. So it's drier than it used to be, and it's also possible that we're starting to see some climate change impacts as well.
And also we have now a pipeline from Wentworth in New South Wales pumping water up to Broken Hill. Why would that happen?
I don't think that's not built yet. It's just been agreed on, hasn't it?
No.
It just got finished, Martin.
Okay. Cool. Yep. All right.
It's in the ground, and also you have the Menindee Lakes up there, which can hold a huge amount of water, and that's also dry. Why would that be dry?
Well, it's for the same reasons of these droughts and wet cycles, and the diversion of water further up the system for agriculture.
Just to summarise, with the two of you,
very polite of you, Martin.
Martin, to summarise, coal seam gas and fracking, we ought to be concerned about because
yes.
we don't know enough about it.
I think we're playing with natural systems that are very variable.
Yep.
So there's lots of things we don't know about the geology. We don't know where the fault lines and the fractures are. So we can't predict where the water's going to go. Also, we will always have boreholes that fail, even though we strive to really get our engineering right. There will always be a couple of percent of boreholes that will leak. And also, as they get older, they get more leaky.
Hmm.
So we have to think very careful about, in the future, what do we do with all these boreholes when we're done with the gas extraction? How do we seal them off? And I think those issues haven't been addressed more thoroughly enough.
Yeah, okay. All right, look, it's been terrific to have your expertise, gentlemen. We could talk about it for hours, and we've probably barely scratched the surface, pardon all these puns.
Mm.
But there you are. Martin Anderson is a professor at the University of New South Wales, and Gavin Mudd, a professor at RMIT. Gentlemen, thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.